Good day to you all, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin with your wake-up call, coming to you from Penang, and it is the famous Friday the 13th of November 2015. And first of all, I need to apologize. We're back to the dark ages. We have a problem, at least I have a problem with my iPad. Locked itself up and can't unlock it, and have had to go, you know, all over the whole area trying to find somebody who can help this, but I think we've probably made the first steps towards restoring iPad capability, so hopefully by Monday's show we should be back in business in the normal way. In the meantime, thanks to Danny Janice, I bring you the latest report from the Cato Institute about the state of America. And it comes on top of a long and increasingly unhappy series of reports on freedom's decline in the U.S. Entitled The Economic Freedom of the World and updated with the latest data available through 2013, the report ranks the United States in 16th position, down from second place when the index was first published in the year 2000. The United States has fallen behind such countries as New Zealand, the United Arab Emirates, Mauritius, Jordan, Ireland, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Chile. Last year's report showed the United States in 12th position. The study measures freedom in five broad areas: the size of government, the security an individual has in his property rights, how sound his currency is, what degree of freedom he has to trade and travel internationally, and how much the government regulates his private and business transactions. Having done this for years, the author of the Cato study notes, and I quote, "Virtually without exception, these studies have found that countries with institutions and policies more consistent with economic freedom have higher investment rates, more rapid economic growth, higher income levels, and a more rapid reduction in poverty rates." End of quote. The Cato study analyzes not only per capita GDP, but income and individual levels, life expectancy rates, and something called personal life satisfaction, which is, according to the authors, and I quote, "the degree to which people feel they are in control of their lives." Economic freedom exerts a strong and persistent impact on both individual life control and life satisfaction. That living in a country with high overall economic freedom is a major determinant of perceived personal control over one's life. End of quote. Sounding like an excerpt from the Declaration of Independence, the authors concluded, quote, "We find that living in a country with high overall economic freedom is a relative dominant determinant of feeling in control of one's own life. Economic freedom influences individual happiness by giving people the feeling of being more in control of their lives and having the freedom to choose between different options in the market." End of quote. Compare that to this: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." What the founders knew to be self-evident has taken a bevy of economists and statisticians at think tanks across the world to confirm. The fifth annual report from Canada's Fraser Institute, the Human Freedom Index, shows the United States falling from 17th to 20th place in just the last year, with one of its authors calling its findings worrisome. The U.S. performance is worrisome and shows that the United States can no longer claim to be the leading bastion of liberty in the world. In addition to the expansion of the regulatory state and drop in economic freedom, the war on terror, the war on drugs, and the erosion of property rights due to the greater use of eminent domain all likely have contributed to the U.S. decline. Unless that decline is halted, they say, it could cut the U.S. historic growth rate of 3% by half. The Heritage Foundation's entry into the discouraging discussion, its 2015 Index of Economic Freedom, showed the United States declining from second place in 2000 to 12th place, with that decline accelerating over the past 5 years, quote-unquote, reflecting the broad-based deterioration in key policy areas, particularly those related to upholding the rule of law and limited government. In another study published by Cato, the United States fell from 17th place worldwide to 20th, reflecting, quote-unquote, a long-term drop in every category of economic freedom and in its rule of law. In a perverse expression of optimism, the authors of the Human Freedom Index study listed some of the nations that are now outperforming the United States in economic freedom: Hong Kong, Singapore, New Zealand, Switzerland, the United Arab Emirates, Mauritius, Jordan, Ireland, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, Georgia, Chile, Qatar, and Taiwan. Wrote the authors, good for them. But honestly, Georgia, Jordan, the UAE, and Qatar? Just 25 years ago, Georgia was the Georgian Soviet Socialist Republic. Its people chained by the dead hand of communist central planning, coercion, and corruption. On a more hopeful note, if even Georgia can throw off its chains, then surely the U.S. can unwind the damage done by 15-plus years of bad federal policies. The continuing decline of economic and personal freedom in the United States proves the adage, the essence of freedom is the limitation of government. Winston Churchill put it well, socialism is a philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance, and the gospel of envy. Its inherent virtue is the equal sharing of misery. End of quote. Think tanks monitoring the decline of economic and personal freedom in the United States also reflect the success of policies set in place long ago. As Rowan Geither, then president of the Ford Foundation, told Norman Dodd, head of the Rees Committee, in 1954, quote, all of us here at the policy-making level have had experience with directives from the White House. The substance of them is that we shall use our grant-making power so as to alter life in the United States so that we can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union. Unquote. Well, titles may have changed over those six decades, but the substance remains. Writing in 1958, Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, said this, quote, in 1931, I was convinced that there was plenty of time to implement the completely organized society, the scientific caste system, the abolition of free will, servitude made acceptable. These things were coming, but not in my lifetime, not even in the time of my grandchildren. 27 years later, I feel a good deal less optimistic. In the West, individual men and women still enjoy a large measure of freedom. But this freedom, and even the desire for this freedom, seem to be on the wane. In the nearly 60 years since those words were penned by the socialist Huxley, the US government has come almost completely unmoored from its constitutional restraints and the entitlement and welfare mentality predicted by him continues to thrive. Just ask the analysts at Cato, Heritage, and Fraser who are tracking the decline. With the growth of government comes the reduction of freedom, just as Jefferson noted in his letter to Edward Carrington in 1788, quote unquote, "The natural progress of things is for liberty to yield and government to gain ground. That natural progress has been aided and abetted by forces and interests working to hasten the decline." All right, well, I often refer to how little economic progress has been made since the 1950s. Of course, the pundits find it very easy to confuse you with a subtle substitution of technological progress for economic progress. As soon as you make the economic point, they'll blindside you with stories of miracle medical inventions or the internet or advances in things like transportation. Don't get deceived by this. It has no effect on poverty or education or social decay. I came across this letter from Bill Bonner recently, in which he describes the situation admirably, so I'm going to read it. Ready? Okay, here goes. "Yesterday, our friend and economist, Pierre Lemieux, challenged the numbers in Monday's diary on the U.S. manufacturing recession. Quote, you write, in real terms, the typical man of working age in the U.S. earns less today than he did in 1975, 40 years ago. Where did you get this data? Even the notably unreliable data of the Census Bureau on median family income are not that dark. All data I know show that in the U.S., real incomes have grown over the last 40 years. I'm sure it is the same in Europe. Some prices have increased, like home prices, relative to other prices. And it is quite certainly more difficult to buy a house now than it was back then. Most other things are easier to afford, including for the typical worker. This is confirmed by casual observation. Look at their cars, their TV sets, their boats, their vacations, their appliances, their restaurants, not to speak of computers. Look at their children's cars, iPhones, shoes, etc. Indeed, look at their hunting or hiking boots with Thinsulate and Gore-Tex." End of text quote. In general, we have little confidence in numbers or statistics. Except for the world of science, where they mean something precise, they are mostly lies and misunderstandings. Many of them are plain wrong. Many are pure inventions. We don't trust them, especially our own. You'd think it would be a fairly simple matter to tell if wages, after you account for inflation, have gone up. But it's not. you can begin with the raw data. Then you need to adjust it for inflation, which is where the trouble comes in. How much is a $1975 worth today? We don't want to mislead readers with faulty numbers, so we put the issue to our research team. The data supports us, says Bonner and Partners researcher Nick Rock. Real income for men was higher throughout the 1970s. The data from the Census Bureau has the average American working man's income in 2012 dollars at about $37,000 in 1972, its highest level of the decade. Today, it's close to $34,000. We also have the news of lower incomes reported as fact in the New York Times on October the 22nd, 2012, and I quote, "The real earnings of the median male have actually declined by 19% since 1970. This means that the median man in 2010 earned as much as the median man did in 1964, nearly half a century ago. Men with less education face an even bleaker picture. Earnings for the median man with a high school diploma and no further schooling fell by 41% from 1970 to 2010. End of quote. But wait, it's not that simple. Pierre again, quote, "The data makes a bit more sense for males. But as I suspected, the figures come from unreliable Census Bureau data. The Census Bureau gets it from its current population survey, which amounts to asking people what they earn. This data is inconsistent with NIPA, that's National Income and Product Accounts data, which contains multiple cross-checks. Total income must be equal to total expenditure and to total value added. Note also that the census data do not include in-kind transfers, such as food stamps, Medicaid, and employee benefits." End of quote. Right. Add in the free company T-shirts and state welfare handouts, and you seem to have a working man who is better off. But he can't be much better off. Just taking the unvarnished numbers, the average working stiff in 1975 earned $8,853 in 1975 dollars. Now he earns $36,302. Ford introduced its F-150 in 1975. We weren't able to find an exact price, but it appears to have been sold at about $5,000. Today, an F-150 supercab sells for about $28,000. The average new home sold for $39,000 in 1975. Today, it sells for $364,100. In very raw terms, if a man wanted to buy a house and a car in 1975, he had to work just under 5 years to pay for them. If he wants a house and a car today, he has to work almost 11 years. Whoa! This makes it sound like his real income has been cut in half. Of course, it's never that simple. He gets more house and more car for his money today. Still, the remarkable thing is that we are doing this calculation at all. We shouldn't be wondering about it. It should be obvious that we're all far better off today than we were half a century ago. This should have been the easiest period in human history in which to make financial progress. Never before had there been so many inventors and entrepreneurs. Never before had they so much accumulated science and capital to work with. Never before had there been so many people making things and so many consumers with money in their pockets to buy them. And never before were there so many earnest lawmakers, PhD economists, curious researchers, diligent policymakers, and non-profit employed do-gooders. Millions of people, all doing their level best to make us happier, healthier, and richer. Something seems to have gone wrong on the way to the future. End of Bill's letter. Well, I truly enjoyed that, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you did too. Well, last week, a consortium of financial regulators in the United States, including the Federal Reserve and the FDIC, issued an astonishing condemnation of the U.S. banking system. Most notably, they highlighted what they called continuing gaps between industry practices and the expectations for safe and sound banking. This is part of an annual report they publish called the Shared National Credit, or SNC, Review. In this year's report, they identified a huge jump in risky loans due to overexposure to weakening oil and gas industries. Make no mistake, this is not chump change. The total exceeds $3.9 trillion worth of risky loans that U.S. banks made with your money. Given that even the Fed is concerned about this, alarm bells should be ringing. All right, well, I just want you to be sure you understand why the rising dollar is such a disaster for emerging markets. Many would say this must be a good thing because a strong dollar means Americans will buy more emerging markets products. But the reality is that emerging markets have to spend a lot more of their own currencies to buy the dollars they need to pay interest on principal on the massive amounts of debt they originally incurred in dollars. So that really does put a completely different slant to the problem, and one again which the mainstream media will do their best to ignore. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, you are absolutely aware, are you not, that the main reason the U.S. economy is struggling to recover from the Great Recession of 2007 and 2008 is that the debt load is so very difficult to overcome. It is, well and truly, all about debt. That is really all there is to it. The global debt has increased by about $60 trillion since 2007, and there's no way to have a smooth and quick recovery after the debt has grown so much, so quickly. Don't forget, either, that the reason for the Great Recession was the overwhelming debt incurred by almost every country, which includes the developed nations as well as the emerging markets. The main reason for the start of the massively increased debt burden was the Federal Reserve reducing the Fed funds rate to 1% in June of 2003 and keeping it there for a year. They thought they were giving relief to the U.S. due to the bursting of the dot-com bubble. They were not aware of the possibility that they were the main cause of the housing bubble, which they were. In fact, the Fed had no idea either that they were the cause of the dot-com bubble after Fed Chairman Greenspan reversed his warning to global investors about the possibility of irrational exuberance in 1998. After the market dipped, it came roaring back enough for the idiot to reverse himself completely. The Federal Reserve also tried to alleviate U.S. investors' concerns by stating that there was no housing bubble in 2005, 2006, and 2007. When the housing bubble turned out to be worse than the dot-com bubble, they invented quantitative easing, or QE, which essentially meant that the Fed bought a tremendous amount of U.S. Treasury securities. The theory, at least, was that by lowering interest rates and buying Treasury securities, that the bank reserves would be increased and that they would find their way into the real economy as loans to businesses and individuals. This turned into QE1, followed by QE2, then QE3, interspersed with Operation Twists, purchases of longer-term treasuries while selling shorter-term treasuries. This caused the Fed's balance sheet to grow from $800 billion in 2007 to $4.5 trillion now. The most amazing part of this was that the rest of the world's central banks decided to copy the Fed and start their own QE, which drove up all of the central banks' balance sheets to outrageous levels. There have been many very sophisticated investors and money managers who have warned about the U.S. debt explosion over the past 35 years, and especially the last 15 years, when the dot-com bubble burst. Just a couple of weeks ago, Stanley Druckenmiller warned about the devastation of the U.S. economy due to the promise of entitlements. He stated that if the entitlements in the U.S., mostly Social Security and Medicare, were paid to everyone that expected to receive them, and the revenues came in as expected over the next 20 years, the national debt would no longer be the $18 to $19 trillion that all of the presidential candidates talk about as an impossible burden. In fact, if you take the present value of the entitlements promised to the expected recipients, the national debt is no longer $18 to $19 trillion, but closer to $205 trillion. Ladies and gentlemen, if that number doesn't scare you, nothing will. David Stockman also has gone through his present value of entitlements that comes in around $80 trillion. Either one shows just how outrageous entitlement promises have become and that they must be corrected. Stockman has also shown the growth in global GDP and global debt from 1994 to the present. He shows that global GDP grew from $28 trillion in 1994 to $78 trillion presently. CAGR, or compound annual growth rate, at 5.3%. And the global debt grew from $40 trillion in 1994 to $225 trillion. Presently, CAGR at 9%. This kind of growth relative to GDP is unprecedented, and this is why the growth in global GDP is being smothered by global debt. The only thing close to this is the growth in debt relative to GDP in the US presently and Japan back in 1989. Well, one of the big things that is contributing to this new global economic slowdown is the unwinding of the US dollar and its carry trade. When the Fed cut interest rates to zero in 2008, it flooded the system with US dollars. The US dollar, as you know, is the reserve currency of the world. No matter what country you're in, with few exceptions, you can borrow in US dollars. And if you can borrow in US dollars at 0.25% and put that money into anything yielding more, you could make a killing. For example, a hedge fund in Hong Kong could borrow $100 million, pay just $250,000 in interest, and plow that money into Brazilian reais, which yielded 11%, locking in a $9.75 million return. This was the strictly financial side of things. On the economics side, governments, both sovereign and local, borrowed in US dollars around the globe to fund various infrastructure and municipal projects. Simply put, the US government was practically giving money away, and the world took notice, borrowing dollars at a record pace. Today, the global carry trade, meaning money borrowed in US dollars and invested in other assets, stands at over $9 trillion, a sum so gargantuan that it's larger than the economies of France and Brazil combined. But now, the US dollar carry trade is starting to unwind because the US dollar has been doing so very well lately. The US dollar has been surging against other global currencies in 2015, and it has put a tremendous amount of stress on emerging markets around the world. All of a sudden, oil, other commodities, and stock markets in nations such as Brazil began to crash. Meanwhile, those that had taken out loans denominated in US dollars were finding that it was taking far more of their own local currencies to service and repay those loans. This final crunch in emerging markets is going to take years to play out fully, and it's going to take a tremendous toll on global markets. Of course, there is precedent for this. We've seen this happen before. A surging dollar helped cause the Latin American debt crisis of the 1980s, the Asian financial crisis of the 1990s, and the major global recession of 2008 and 2009. If you thought that the financial shaking that happened in late August was bad, that was nothing compared to what is now heading our way. Well, to change the subject slightly here, when it comes to the bellicose and crude warmongering predilection of America, little can beat the raw ugliness of a certain Henry Kissinger. I'm going to read you a passage by Greg Grandin, who teaches history at New York University. He is the author of Forlandia, The Empire of Necessity, which won the Bancroft Prize in American History, and most recently, Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. Within days of Richard Nixon's inauguration in January 1969, National Security Advisor Kissinger asked the Pentagon to lay out his bombing options in Indochina. The previous president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, had suspended his own bombing campaign against North Vietnam in hopes of negotiating a broader ceasefire. Kissinger and Nixon were eager to relaunch it, a tough task given domestic political support for the bombing halt. The next best option, begin bombing across the border in Cambodia, to destroy enemy supply lines, depots, and bases supposedly located there. Nixon and Kissinger also believed that such an onslaught might force Hanoi to make concessions at the negotiating table. On February the 24th, Kissinger and his military aide, Colonel Alexander Haig, met Air Force Colonel Ray Sitton, an expert on B-52 bombers, to begin the planning of MENU, the grim culinary code name for the bombing campaign to come. Given that Nixon had been elected on a promise to end the war in Vietnam, Kissinger believed that it wasn't enough to place MENU in the category of top secret. Absolute and total secrecy, especially from Congress, was a necessity. He had no doubt that Congress, crucial to the appropriation of funds needed to conduct specific military missions, would never approve a bombing campaign against a neutral country with which the United States wasn't at war. Instead, Kissinger, Haig, and Sitton came up with an ingenious deception. Based on recommendations from General Creighton Abrams, commander of military operations in Vietnam, Sitton would lay out the Cambodian targets to be struck, then run them by Kissinger and Haig for approval. Next, he would back-channel their coordinates to Saigon, and a courier would deliver them to radar stations where the officer in charge would, at the last minute, switch B-52 bombing runs over South Vietnam to the agreed-upon Cambodian targets. Later, that officer would burn any relevant maps, computer printouts, radar reports, or messages that might reveal the actual target. A whole special furnace was set up to dispose of the records, Abraham would later testify before Congress. We burned probably 12 hours a day. False post-strike paperwork would then be written up, indicating that the sorties had been flown over South Vietnam as planned. Kissinger was very hands-on. Strike here in this area, Sitton recalled Kissinger telling him, or strike here in that area. The bombing galvanized the National Security Advisor. The first raid occurred on March the 18th, 1969. Kay really excited, Bob Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, wrote in his diary. He came beaming into the Oval Office with the report. In fact, he would supervise every aspect of the bombing. As journalist Seymour Hersh later wrote, when the military men presented a proposed bombing list, Kissinger would redesign the mission, shifting a dozen planes, perhaps from one area to another, and altering the timing of the bombing runs. He seemed to enjoy playing the bombardier. That joy wouldn't be limited to Cambodia. According to Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, when the bombing of North Vietnam finally started up again, Kissinger, quote-unquote, expressed enthusiasm at the size of the bomb craters. A Pentagon report released in 1973 stated that, quote-unquote, Henry A. Kissinger approved each of the 3,875 Cambodia bombing raids in 1969 and 1970. The most secretive phase of the bombing, as well as the methods for keeping them out of the papers. End of quote. All told, between 1969 and 1973, the U.S. dropped 500,000 tons of bombs on Cambodia alone, killing at least 100,000 civilians. And don't forget Laos and both North and South Vietnam. Quote, it's wave after wave of planes. You see, they can't see the B-52, and they dropped 1,000,000 pounds of bombs. End of quote. And that was Kissinger telling Nixon after the April 1972 bombing of North Vietnam's port city of Haiphong, as he tried to reassure the president that the strategy was working. Quote, "I bet you we will have had more planes over there in one day than Johnson had in a month. Each plane can carry about 10 times the load a World War II plane could carry." End of quote. As the months passed, however, the bombing did nothing to force Hanoi to the bargaining table. It did, on the other hand, help Kissinger in his inter-office rivalries. His sole source of power was Nixon, who was a bombing advocate. So Kissinger embraced his role as first bombardier to show the tough guy militarists the president had surrounded himself with that he was the hawk of hawks. And yet, in the end, even Nixon came to see that the bombing campaigns were a dead end. Quote, "Kay, we have had 10 years of total control of the air in Laos and Vietnam." Nixon wrote him over a top-secret report on the efficacy of bombing. "The result equals zilch." End of quote. This was in January 1972, 3 months before Kissinger assured Nixon that wave after wave of bombers would do the trick. During those 4.5 years when the U.S. military dropped more than 6 million tons of bombs on Southeast Asia, Kissinger revealed himself to be not a supreme political realist, but the planet's supreme idealist. He refused to quit when it came to a policy meant to bring about a world he believed he ought to live in, one where he could, by the force of the material power of the U.S. military, bend poor peasant countries like Cambodia, Laos, and North Vietnam to his will, as opposed to the one he did live in, where, bomb as he might, he couldn't force Hanoi to submit. As he put it at the time, and here I will invoke my best Kissinger accent, "I refuse to believe that a little fourth-rate power like North Vietnam does not have a breaking point." In fact, that bombing campaign did have one striking effect. It destabilized Cambodia, provoking a 1970 coup that in turn provoked a 1970 American invasion, which only broadened the social base of the insurgency growing in the countryside, leading to escalating U.S. bombing runs that spread to nearly the whole country, devastating it and creating the conditions for the rise to power of the genocidal Khmer Rouge. Ladies and gentlemen, if you think that the spirit of goodness and kindness has swept over America since those days, I feel sorry for you. If you believe, on the other hand, as I do, that America's anger and spirit of revenge on the world has grown immeasurably since then, you're in good company. Again, it is your responsibility to make the correct decisions for your and your family's future. But I cannot stress enough how urgent it is for you to leave the U.S. without delay. And that, of course, is extremely timely for a certain Lou Baroud, who happens to be traveling in just those countries right now. He's just left Laos. I heard from him today. He called me up. We had quite a long chat. He is headed into Cambodia, and from there, I believe he is headed into Vietnam. So, Lou, if you're listening, I hope this is relevant material to your travels, and it should really give you some kind of a historic background into the horrors you will be hearing about Cambodia as you travel through. And, of course, being in Cambodia, they will emphasize America's part in all this, something which, of course, America doesn't do itself when discussing the history of Cambodia. I can only hope that I have helped to redress the balance today. Well, as you know, at least those who've been listening to the show for a couple of years, I've spent quite a lot of time talking about happiness and what it means for those who are actively seeking it. And as you know, you have the right to pursue it. Well, a scientific study just released found that U.S. adults are becoming less happy over the years. Adults over 30 are less happy than their predecessors, according to the study, which was published online last Thursday in the journal Social Psychology and Personality Science. The study examined happiness data for more than 50,000 adults, gleaned from the General Social Survey carried out by NORC at the University of Chicago, a non-partisan independent research organization which has been collecting information about American adults since 1972. From 2010 to 2014, adults over 30 had an average happiness score of just 2.18, compared with 2.24 a decade ago. That's significant, considering happiness scores were measured on a tiny scale from just 1 to 3, with 1 being not too happy and 3 being very happy. Americans are more depressed now than they have been in decades, according to another recent study. San Diego State University psychology professor Jean M. Twenge analyzed data from nearly 7 million adolescents and adults from across the country and found that more people reported symptoms of depression, including sleeplessness and trouble concentrating, compared to the 1980s. Twenge's findings show that teenagers in the 2010s experience memory trouble 38% more often than their 1980s counterparts. Teens are also 74% more likely to have trouble sleeping and twice as likely to see a professional for mental health issues. College students in the study reported feeling overwhelmed by academic and personal demands, and 50% more often than their 1980s counterparts. In 1987, 61.1% of all Americans reported being happy at work. Today, 52.3% of all Americans say that they are unhappy at work. A different survey found that 70% of all Americans do not, quote-unquote, feel engaged or inspired at their jobs. One survey of 50-year-old men in the United States found that only 12% of them said that they were, quote-unquote, very happy. The number of Americans diagnosed with depression increases by about 20% each year. According to the New York Times, more than 30 million Americans take antidepressants. Doctors in the United States write more than 250 million prescriptions for antidepressants each year. The rate of antidepressant use among middle-aged women is far higher than for the population as a whole. One out of every four women in their 40s and 50s is currently taking an antidepressant medication. Compared to children in Europe, children in the United States are three times more likely to be prescribed antidepressants. 60 million people abuse alcohol, and 22 million people use illegal drugs in the United States. America has the highest rate of illegal drug use in the world. One recent poll found that 71% of Americans are dissatisfied with the direction that things are going in this country. America has the highest divorce rate in the world by a wide margin. America has the highest percentage of one-person households in the world. 100 years ago, 4.52 people formed the average U.S. household, but now that figure stands at 2.59. According to the Pew Research Center, 51% of all American adults are married, compared with 72% in 1960. The suicide rate is now the highest it's been in 25 years. I've talked a lot about this, too, as you will know. The rate of suicide is an unmistakable sign of dissatisfaction a society can exhibit. Apparently, 22 military veterans kill themselves in the United States every single day, according to another study. The suicide rate for Americans between 35 and 64 rose by close to 30% between 1999 and 2010. The number of Americans dying by suicide now exceeds those who die as a result of automobile accidents every year. The rate of suicide is highest during the end-of-year holidays, and 45% of all Americans say that they dread the Christmas season. The following comes from a Psychology Today article, and I quote, "We are told that Christmas, for Christians, should be the happiest time of year, an opportunity to be joyful and grateful with family, friends, and colleagues. Yet, according to the National Institute of Health, Christmas is the time of year that people experience the highest incidence of depression. Hospitals and police forces report the highest incidences of suicide and attempted suicide. Psychiatrists, psychologists, and other mental health professionals report a significant increase in patients complaining about depression. One North American survey reported that 45% of respondents dreaded the festive season." Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'll leave the pontificating to others. The facts do the job quite nicely, thank you. And with that, I think we'll call it a day. It has been a pleasure speaking to you. I am very sorry and apologetic about the quality of the reception, which will, of course, have reduced itself dramatically, reminding you of how lucky we are to have the new technology at our fingertips when the fingertips are dry. Right now they are very wet, and I shall have to take steps tomorrow to deal with this, but steps I will take, and hopefully by Monday, as I said, all will be well. But in the meantime, I am hoping that you will all enjoy a wonderful weekend. So until Monday, this is Richard Martin wishing you all the best. Take care. Until then, bye-bye.